we are in the towards the end of chapter 4 of Deuteronomy, okay? And if you remember, Deuteronomy 4 is the kind of the transition chapter from the historical prologue to the general stipulations, which will start in chapter 5, okay? So chapter 4, Moses is summing everything up to prepare to start to give the law in chapter 5, okay? And we talked about last time, the end of last time, that, well, in chapter 4, really, there are two huge events, Mount Sinai and the Exodus. And these two events are the defining events of Israel. This is how Israel knows God, primarily, through the Exodus, where they saw God work, totally demolish the world power of the day, and through Mount Sinai, right, where God revealed himself, specifically the Ten Commandments, when God spoke directly to the people, freaked them out. They didn't want it anymore, said Moses, how about you get the law from God, and then we'll go from there. Then you just tell us, okay? But that was God's revelation, Mount Sinai. So this is how, I'm sorry?
Was this before or after they built the calf?
Before, the Ten Commandments happened before, because it happened in Exodus 20. The golden calf is Exodus 32, I believe, yes. No, that's fine. Because the people say, we don't want to hear directly from God. Moses, you go talk to God. So Moses goes up the mountain, and then he's gone for 40 days. And then they're like, oh, I guess Moses just disappeared. Aaron, build us a god. So Aaron says, okay. Then the golden calf, and then Moses comes down and breaks the first set of the Ten Commandments. Okay. But what we talked about at the very end of last week, right, is that God lets them know how this is all going to end, right? Verse 25 of chapter 4. When you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land and act corruptly and make an idol in the form of anything and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God so as to provoke him to anger, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that you will surely perish quickly from the land where you are going over the Jordan to possess it. You shall not live long on it, but will be utterly destroyed. So God says, this is how you're supposed to act. You're not supposed to have an idol. If you obey, you'll live long in the land. But guess what? You're not going to do it. You're going to fail. Okay? You, this generation might be fine, but when you're in the land, you are going to forget God, and you are going to forget the covenant that you have with God, and you are going to act corruptly. Right? So the thing is, Israel might at this point just throw in the towel and say, why even bother if it's all just going to end badly, right? But then, verse 29, but from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search for him with all your heart and all your soul. When you are in distress and all these things have come upon you in the latter days, you will return to the Lord your God and listen to his voice. So God lets them know they are going to fail, but there is coming a day when they will be restored. They will return to God. He will hear them. What Moses doesn't tell them is how this is going to come about, right? Because up to this point, Israel should know from their history that they cannot do it. They cannot obey. They cannot live perfectly with God, right? But God says that someday in the latter days, remember, and we trace that back to Genesis 49, when Genesis 49, when Jacob is on his deathbed and he's giving a blessing to all his sons, and he talks about Judah, there will be a scepter from Judah, and it talks about how there's going to be peace in the land and everybody's going to have a donkey and tie it to their grapevine, which is peace and prosperity for everyone, right? And it talks about Genesis 49:1 says, I can't remember what the exact term is, but it's the days to come. And it's literally the same words as latter days, okay? So Genesis 49 is talking about the latter days. Here in Deuteronomy 4, we have the latter days. And we know that Judah, the kingly line did come from Judah, but we still don't have the absolute fulfillment of that promise. They had peace and prosperity under Solomon, but it didn't last very long, right? End of David and Solomon, because after that, the nation was split in two, and we don't have that yet. So those days are still to come, okay? So God is promising Israel, in the latter days, you will cry out, and I will hear you, and you will be made right with God, OK? Okay? So it's bad news, good news, right? Israel, you are going to fail, but don't lose heart. There is coming a day. Remember when we talked about the unfaithfulness triangle? Do we remember this? Right? One side is God's covenant promises, and then Israel's unfaithfulness, and then God's faithfulness, both to keep the covenant promises, but also to judge Israel. Right? That triangle, that cycle will be broken. Okay? Moses doesn't tell us how here, but he is telling Israel, don't lose heart. There is hope. Okay? There is hope for the future. There will come a day when everything will be made right. Okay? But here he does not tell us how. Okay, any questions from last week or anything up to this point? Okay, so we're going to finish up Deuteronomy 4 today. Try to start 5. We'll see how far we get. Can somebody read for me Deuteronomy 4, 32 to 40? Through 40, yes.
Or has God tried to go to take for himself a nation from within another nation by trials, by signs and wonders and by war, and by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? To you it was shown that you might know that the Lord, he is God. There is no other besides him. Out of heaven he let you hear his voice to discipline you, and on earth he let you see his great fire, and you heard his words from the midst of the fire. Because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he personally brought you from Egypt by his great power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and to give you the land for an inheritance, as it is today. Know therefore today, and take it to your heart, that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God has given you for all time.
Okay, so Moses starts in verse 32, right? He's talking about history. Indeed, ask now concerning the former days which were before you, since the day that God created man on earth. So he's appealing to all of history from day 6 onwards. So from the very beginning of time on. And his point is, right, and inquire from one end of the heavens to the other, has anything been done like this great thing, or has anything been heard like it? God has acted in ways, done things for Israel that are without parallel. Nothing is even comparable, okay? In all of history, from day 6 to this point, and even to our point now, God has done things for Israel that he has not done with any other nation, or have not even been done anywhere. Okay, verse 33. Has any people heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire as you have heard it and survived? So this is talking about Mount Sinai when God gave the Ten Commandments. Okay? In all of history, there is no event like Mount Sinai. None. Okay, even in fiction, even in mythology, any of it, there is no God that has acted like this with their people. Okay, where he speaks from fire directly to the people and they live, right? Because there is no God like Yahweh. That they even survived was a miracle, right? That they heard God's direct voice and they survived is a miracle, right? God can do the impossible. There is no event in all of history like Sinai. Okay, verse 34, what's the second event? Or has a God tried to go to take for himself a nation from within another nation by trials, by signs and wonders, and by war, and by a mighty hand, and by an outstretched arm, and by great terrors, as the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your eyes? There is no event in history like the Exodus. None. Okay, no. Nothing ever happened where a nation was fully enslaved to another nation and their God came in and absolutely decimated the world power. Right? And this isn't just a nation inside another nation. This is the world power of the day. Okay? There is no event like that in history. Nothing even comes close to being comparable. Right? Israel, well, and if you really think about it, it's hilarious. The Israelites didn't even really want to leave. They kept fighting against God too. So God basically drug them out kicking and screaming, so he didn't even have the cooperation of his own people. Okay? And he still saved them. Okay, but there is no event like that in history. So God has done things for Israel that no other God has done for their people. He's just the superlatives, the things that God has done are just piled up, right? By trials, signs, and wonders. Okay, everything that was done before Pharaoh, I mean, there were miracles, the stick going into the snake and the water to blood and all the 10 plagues. By a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm, right? This is God's powerful act. Oh, it says signs and wonders and by war. Yeah, who fought that war? Yeah, did Israel even do anything?
No, not
literally nothing except for complain. Okay, so God himself is the warrior. He went to war for Israel. He performed the signs and wonders. It was with his mighty hand and outstretched arm. Do you remember when the magicians, Pharaoh's magicians, kept trying to duplicate, right, Moses' plagues, and they could only get so far? And do you remember what they said to Pharaoh when they couldn't do it anymore?
This God is greater than ours.
He said, they say, truly, this is the, do you remember? The finger of God, right? Even just those little things, they're like, this God is so great that we've only seen the finger of God. It's only the tiniest bit, right? And that's only a couple plagues in, and then we still have all the rest, and then we have them all drowning in the Red Sea, okay? So that is the power of God, the mighty hand and outstretched arm. And that says, and by great terrors, right? Fear, because of the Exodus, fear falls on other nations when they hear what Yahweh did to Egypt. Okay? That Israel even exists, right, is because of God's faithfulness. That they were not subsumed by Egypt, right, or totally wiped out by Egypt, which the pharaohs tried to do. But that God plucked them out of another nation and brought them into their own land. Right? This proves God's faithfulness, and that proves that God is God and all he says will come true. Okay? God has acted with Israel in ways that no other nation has seen. Not even close. I mean, and we even look today that Israel as a nation exists today is a miracle. I mean, because they didn't exist from 70 AD till 1948. For 2,000 years almost, they didn't exist. Yeah, no, they should have been. Yes. Well, that they even survived one day after they declared nationhood, right? Because they declared nationhood and went to war immediately because the surrounding nations don't want them there. And that so that they even exist is still evidence of God's faithfulness. And it's because, right, God still has a plan. The latter days still are not here. There will be peace in Israel, brought not by the Antichrist, but by God himself. Okay, those days are coming when Israel will fulfill her rightful place and will reign and will fulfill all the promises that God has made her. Okay, but we can look back to Israel's history and we can see that God has acted with them in ways he does not act with any other nation. Right, and it proves the faithfulness of God. And this second generation should be able to look back and then have great confidence that God is going to help them conquer Canaan. Okay. Verse 35, to you it was shown that you might know that the Lord, he is God. There is no other besides him, right? The point, God is God, there is no other, right? Sinai and the Exodus are the two main ways that Israel knows who Yahweh is, okay? But it's enough to know that Yahweh is the only true God, right? Because Exodus, God is demolishing the gods of Egypt, right? And Mount Sinai, they audibly heard God's voice. There is no denying that he is real, Okay, he is God. He is the only God. And also at Sinai, they got the rest of the covenant, right? And so they have divine revelation of who God is and how he wants them to act. Okay. Verse 36, out of the heavens, again, this is Mount Sinai, out of the heavens, he let you hear his voice to discipline you. He treats Israel like a father treats a son. Okay. Sinai was to show Israel that God is their authority and they need to obey, right? And we talked about that all through Exodus, that they were going to go from being slaves of Egypt to slaves of God. There is no freedom is to be a slave of God. You are always a slave of something. Okay. And on earth, he let you see his great fire and you heard his words from the midst of the fire. Because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he personally brought you from Egypt by his great power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in and to give you their land for an inheritance as it is today. Know therefore today and take it to your heart that the Lord, he is God in heaven above and on earth below. There is no other. Okay, no God has ever cared for his people like God has cared for Israel. I mean, if you even think of like the Greek gods or the Roman gods or Baal or whatever, all they are people with, you know, they're like our superheroes today in the Marvel films, right? They have some sort of extra power, but they're just people. They're selfish. They think only about themselves. People are just a means for them to get what they want, okay? So no God even really cares for his people very much. And yet here we have Yahweh God who has poured himself out to save Israel despite their rebellion, despite their complaining, despite everything they do to try to get God to not, right? Yet he cares for them. He brought them out of Egypt and he revealed himself, spoke to them at Sinai. Okay, so no God has ever cared for their people like God has cared for Israel. This is the first time in Deuteronomy that explicitly says that God chose Israel. Okay, right? Verse 37, because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. Okay, deliverance from Egypt is proof of this love. And if God can do this in Egypt, he can deliver Canaan to them as well. Verse 39, know therefore today and take it to your heart, right? This second generation, they need to truly believe this and behave accordingly. They need to have great faith in God and see what he has done throughout history and therefore be able to walk forth in great confidence, okay? Knowing that because of what he's done in the past, what he is capable to do in the future. And again, the point, there is no other God. He is God in heaven above. There is no other. Verse 40, so you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I am giving you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, and that you may live long on the land which the Lord your God is giving you for all time. Okay? Because of all of this, because of what God has done for them, because of the miracles that they have witnessed, because of the care that God has for them, right? They are to obey. So you shall keep his statutes and his commandments. They are to obey the law. They are to be faithful because God is faithful. Okay? This sets up for the detailed laws that are going to follow. And obedience, notice, what happens if they obey? Yes, what kind of blessings? Specifically what? Prolong your days. Obedience leads to horizontal blessings, okay? We have said over and over again, the law does not fix your heart problem, okay? You can have the law. You can even adhere to the external forms of the law, right? And your heart is not changed, okay? So the law does not fix your heart problem, and so therefore the law does not save you. But what the law does is if you live, because We're going to see the law really just corresponds with reality. Oh, shocker, because, you know, God created reality and he creates the law, so they correspond. So if you do the things in the law which correspond with reality, things are going to go well for you because you're living in reality, as opposed to what we see people today trying to make their own realities, which then they just end up falling flat on their face because their quote-unquote truth doesn't correspond with reality because they just made it up in their head. Okay, so if you live in accordance with God's truth, you're going to get horizontal blessings. Okay? But
you have to be, one little word of caution though, is keeping it as a part of promise.
Right.
For everyone.
No, right. Right, exactly. It's not, it's like kind of like Proverbs, right? They're principles to guide life. They're not absolute, you know, if you do A, then it is guaranteed that B will happen. They are general principles about how life typically works, right? Obviously, there are always exceptions to everything. But God is saying here, you obey my statutes, and most of the time it's going to go well with you. Doesn't mean that there's not going to be some freak accident, right? And you get hit on the head with a falling tree branch or struck by lightning or something like that. He's not saying that those things aren't going to still happen. But as a general rule, you live in line with reality, with God's revealed truth. It's going to go well with you. You're going to have a long life. Okay, so there's horizontal blessings. But a lot of people say, right, oh, in the Old Testament, you were saved by obeying the law. No, the Old Testament doesn't ever teach that. You were never saved in that your heart made right with God, right, by obeying the law. That was never the case. Questions through verse 40.
It's more of just interesting where in verse 40 where it says that you may prolong your days in the land.
Right.
So it's almost like pointing to that eventually the land isn't going to be here for a time. I mean, I don't know if that's what he meant, but it's just interesting that he specifies prolong your days in the land, not just prolong your days of life.
Right. Well, because even back in verse 25, right, he's already said, you're going to live long in the land. Oh, and then what's going to happen? You're going to act corruptly. And then what's going to happen later on? You're going to lose the land. You're going to lose, we talked about last week, you're going to lose your numbers. You're going to now be, God promised to make you many. Now you're going to be small. God promised you the land. Now you're going to lose the land. Okay, so you are going to lose your blessings. Why? Because you disobey the law. You break the covenant. If you keep the law, keep the covenant, you're going to stay in the land because that was part of the blessing. And you're going to live long in the land. But when you disobey, you're going to lose those horizontal blessings as well. Other questions? Okay, can someone read for me verse 41 to 49?
Then Moses set apart three cities in the east beyond the Jordan, that the manslayer might flee there. Anyone who kills his neighbor unintentionally without being at enmity with him in time past, he may flee to one of these cities and save his life. Bezer in the wilderness on the tableland of the Reubenites, Ramoth in Gilead for the Gadites, and Golan in Bashan for the Manassites. This is the law that Moses set before the people of Israel. These are the testimonies, the statutes, and the rules which Moses spoke to the people of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Beyond the Jordan and the valley opposite Beth Peor, in the land of Sihon and the king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon, whom Moses and the people of Israel defeated when they came out of Egypt. And they took possession of his land in the land of Og, the king of Bashan, the two kings of the Amorites who lived in the east beyond the Jordan. From Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of the Arnon, as far as Mount Sirion, that is Hermon, together with all the Araba on the east side of the Jordan, as far as the Sea of Araba, under the slopes of Pisgah.
Okay. So, verse 41 to 43, we get the cities of refuge. Okay, if you remember, we've talked about this before. These cities are set up in the land that, remember, if you killed somebody by accident, and really if you even you killed somebody on purpose, right, you would flee to one of these cities because in the ancient Near East, this is the way the law worked. If you killed somebody, that person's nearest male relative, it was their job to come and kill you. And that was fine. Okay? So in the ancient Near East, you kill someone, murder, purposeful, or accident, manslaughter, you know, it is the job of the nearest male relative to come and seek you out and kill you, Okay? And he would not be punished for doing so. Okay? So God sets up these cities of refuge, right? Because God is saying there is mercy in the law. We're gonna learn when we get to the do not murder command, that word for murder in the Hebrew includes both manslaughter and murder. Okay? So the law says don't kill people. Don't kill people, either on purpose or by accident. Because killing somebody on accident is still wrong. It's still sin. It is not your place. It is only God's place to take life like that. Okay? So you are not to take life by that. But we live in a fallen world. Accidents happen, right? And even here it says, verse 42, that a manslayer might flee there who unintentionally slew his neighbor. Okay? And remember we talked about this, I believe it's in Numbers, right? Where you kill somebody by accident, right? You have to run to one of these cities. Then the man, what's he called? I can't remember. But the vengeance person, right? Who's going to come running after you. He's going to come to the city. And the elders of that city then hold court. And they have to decide, did you kill the person on purpose or did you kill the person on accident? If it's determined that you killed the person on accident, then you could live, your life was spared, but you had to live in that city of refuge until the high priest died. Okay, you didn't get to go back home. Why? You broke the law. You killed. Okay, so there is still a consequence, but you don't have to pay with it with your life. Okay, then once the high priest dies, then you are allowed to go back to your home and that person cannot kill you. And if he does, then he is guilty of murder now.
You better hope the high priest is an old guy.
Well, you better hope you just don't ever kill someone. I think maybe that's a better option, but yes.
In these cities,
yes.
could their relatives come in and see
yes.
them?
And, yes.
Okay, they just could never.
They could not go beyond the boundaries of the city. Okay. And if they did, and the vengeance person killed them, then that was their own fault. I mean, then he would not be punished for murder because you did not obey the rules, the laws, okay? But these cities of refuge, right, show three things about the law. First, that there are degrees of sin. We don't like to talk about this sometimes, but there are degrees of sin, right? You shall not murder. Well, there are even degrees of murder, and that's here, intentional and unintentional. I mean, we think of murder, right, as intentional, but there are degrees of taking a life, intentional or unintentional. So there are degrees of sin, okay? So two, there is mercy in the law, right? The law recognizes that the punishment should not be the same for hating someone and lying in wait and purposefully taking their life, right? Or I'm chopping wood and my axe head flies off and knocks you in the head and you die. Right? Obviously not intentional. Okay? So there are degrees of sin and there is mercy built in the law. Okay? Third, sin is messy in a fallen world. There can be many layers of sin. So the laws have to accommodate complex sinful situations. And this is why the law is never enough. Okay, because the law can never truly regulate sinful man, right? Because, and we see it in America, especially in tax law, right? You make a tax law, you want this. What do people work really hard to do? Find some loophole or way around. So then you write another law to try to close that loophole. And what do? Find another one, and then you close that loophole. I mean, and that's why our tax code is like this long, right? Because we're sinful. Man is inherently sinful, and the law can never regulate all of sin, right? Because we are sinful beyond degree and very creative in our sin, and we will always find a way, okay? So the problem isn't the law. The problem is people, and it's their heart, okay? So people can sin in multiple ways at one time, so obviously the law can never truly control it all. The law can only regulate the damage that sin causes. Okay, the law will never change the heart of man. And that is why we need Christ. Okay, because the heart of man has to be dealt with. And that is the only thing that brings about true lasting change, is when the heart of man is changed. You can pile law upon law upon law upon law, and you will never change the heart of man. And man will just get more and more and more creative to find different ways to sin. Okay? So, but God, in his infinite wisdom, at least for this piece of sin, right, he's going to set up six cities total, but Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh already have their inheritance. So the need for these cities is immediate. They're already spread out on Transjordan, right? So even before they cross into the land, Moses sets up these cities so that while they're conquering the land, if somebody accidentally kills somebody, there is a place for them to go. Okay? So that they will not be judged unjustly. Okay? Then verse 44 to 49. Yes. Oh, please.
I have a note from a couple months ago. I read through here in preparation for this, and I wrote post-it notes. And it says, why is this even included here? The thing about the cities of refuge.
Right.
Why
it's. Right. So it's going to be addressed, I believe, in chapter 19 again. I think it's 19. Yes. Chapter 19, we're going to get a lot more about it, okay? But I think it's addressed right here because we already need it right now. He needs to set them up Transjordan because they're about to cross into the land, but Reuben, Gad, Half, and Manasseh are going to leave all their women and children and a bunch of their men behind. Okay, to protect their women and children and flocks. And so there needs to be more than just a theoretical, yeah, you're going to get cities. Well, because that's already been in Numbers, right, where he says there are going to be these cities of refuge when you get the land. Well, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, they already have their inheritance. So they need those cities before everybody crosses into the land so that they have a place to go, something to do if there is an accidental killing. My question was, what happened when there was an accidental killing, you know, 40 years wandering or yesterday or, you know, what did they do? I don't know.
How many cities are there in total?
Six, three on each side. So three in Transjordan.
The tribes get three cities.
Yes.
The other tribes, which are so many, only get three.
Yes. They are spread out, and if there was a Transjordan city that was closer to you, there's nothing to stop you from going there. So if you live close to the Jordan River and there's a city across the river that's closer, I mean, you would run to the city that's closest. So I think they are strategically placed so that they're not all, like, clustered in Judah or something. And that's why there's not just one, Jerusalem. You know, it's so that no matter where you are, you can get to one fairly easily. Because if there's one up north, even in Galilee, that, you know, across the Sea of Galilee, that might be closer for some people than the other one. So, but yes, I don't know why, but it's three and three. That's how it is.
Maybe
yes.
I have a note in here that says these three verses, 41 to 43,
yep,
are a narrative insert. They inserted them at the end of Moses.
Yeah.
I don't know. The setting aside of three cities on the east side showed Moses willingly obeyed the commandments God gave him. It was an example of the type of obedience
okay.
God was calling.
Yeah, what you see, so I think what that's saying is if you look at the end of verse 40, it has a closed quotation mark, right? So it's like Moses is done talking,
right?
And now he's saying what happened before. If you look at verse 5, chapter 5, verse 1, Moses starts talking again. So that's what it's saying. So when Moses actually wrote down what he had said. So if you're standing there as the second generation listening, right, you probably would have heard verse 40 and then chapter 5, verse 1, right? Moses didn't. So, but this is telling us what Moses did. Okay, so probably even before he started Deuteronomy, saying Deuteronomy to the people, he probably would have already set these up, okay? But this here inserted here is Moses telling us that, hey, I've taken care of all the details so that the second generation can cross over to the land, everything's done, everything's taken care of in Transjordan, we've obeyed everything that God has already said. in numbers, right, to set up these cities of refuge. Moses, before he died, right, because he's about to die. He's about to go up the mountain and die. And as soon as he dies, there's a month of mourning, and then they can cross over the river. Okay? So he is taking care of everything that he can prior to his death. They haven't crossed over the land. They haven't conquered Canaan yet. So those three cities are done in Joshua, are set up in Joshua. Any other questions? I would say that the people who kill other people will be by far the minority. They just, so wherever the tribe, wherever these cities of refuge are located, whoever owns that land. So this would probably be one in Manasseh, one in Reuben, and one in Gad. So the Gadites, the Reubenites, and the Manassites would have just lived in these cities. And then also people from other places and possibly other tribes who have killed people who have fled there. And then it was the job of those elders in the... Oh, you know what? That's wrong. I'm pretty sure the cities of refuge were Levite cities. I think they were. So it was the Levites. Now, okay, because if you remember, the Levites, they don't get an inheritance, okay? So they got cities all throughout Israel, and the cities of refuge were Levitical cities. So primarily the Levites would have lived in that city, and then people from other tribes who have killed people. But then it was their job to determine murder or manslaughter, right? And if it's murder... In Numbers, I think it's like the trial takes place outside the city so that if the judgment is murder, the person can just be killed right there, right? Because the punishment for murder is death, okay? And so then you can just be killed out, and you want to be killed outside the city because that makes everybody unclean, and you don't want that in the city, okay? But if the verdict is manslaughter, then that person is then ushered safely back into the city, and then they cannot leave the city until the death of the high priest. But yes, I believe, I'm pretty sure it's the Levites who live in these cities. Yes, but then conducted by the elders, the leaders of that Levitical city. Yeah, right. I mean, it wouldn't be like super far, but yes, outside the city limits, so that if the judgment is murder, then they can just kill the person right there. I don't know. Maybe.
I don't think there was another method.
Being impaled and hung on a tree was one, but I don't know. I can't remember. I don't know. I'm sure we will get there. I'm sure we'll say in Deuteronomy.
How they just took care of it right then.
Yeah.
You know, there was none of this long, drawn out.
Right, right.
Yes. Way is like this way,
I'm right. What?
It's do it or not.
Right. Right.
There's Numbers 35:6. The cities you give the Levites will include six cities of refuge.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So.
It took me a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Good question, Helen. Any other questions? All right, the rest of chapter 4, verses 44 to 49. This is very similar to chapter 1, verses 1 to 5. Okay, it's just a summary of where Israel is, okay, what's about to happen. And it sets up for the giving of the law, okay? This is the law which Moses set before the sons of Israel. These are testimonies, statutes, ordinances which Moses spoke to the sons of Israel when they came out of Egypt. Where are they? Across the Jordan, in the valley opposite Beth Peor, in the land of Sihon. Remember, we're always reminded about Sihon and Og, king of the Amorites who lived at Heshbon, who Moses and the son of Israel defeated when they came out of Egypt. Yeah, 40 years later. They took possession of his land in the land of Og, king of Bashan, the two kings of the Amorites who were across the Jordan to the east. Okay, so it's just positioning them where they are. They're across the Jordan. They're east of the Jordan. They're about ready to hear the law. Moses is going to die. Then they're going to cross into the promised land. Okay? So this sets up. They're ready for what Moses is going to say next, which is going to be the Ten Commandments. Okay? So this sets in Israel's mind the moment in time when the second generation becomes accountable before God. Okay, because when they hear the Ten Commandments, when they hear the rest of the law given, they're going to be accountable before God. Questions, chapter 4. Okay. All right, now the doozy starts.
Why wouldn't the second generation technically be accountable for the law? Because the first generation has all been killed off.
Right, because they were technically not old enough when the law was given the first time. And we'll talk about that in chapter 5. Well, they would have been. It's not that they wouldn't have known what Moses is going to say. It wouldn't be like when Moses gives the Ten Commandments, they're like, oh my goodness, I've never even heard this before. Okay? But what the way Moses is going to speak in chapter 5, he's going to basically say, it's as if you we're standing in the place of your fathers at Sinai. This covenant is as applicable to you as if God spoke it directly to you. Now, some of this second generation would have heard God speak at Sinai, right? Because if you were 19 years old, right, not counted in the 20, you could still very well be alive now, 40 years later, you would be 59, right? And you could have been there when God spoke, right? But let's say now you're 23. You wouldn't have been born yet. You would have been born sometime during the 40 years of wandering, and you would have never heard God audibly speak at Sinai. But Moses is going to talk to the entire second generation. It's as if you were there. This covenant is as applicable to you as if you were standing there and you audibly heard God speak. Okay? And we'll get there. All right. Deuteronomy 5, we are most likely not even going to get into Deuteronomy 5 today. Okay, so Deuteronomy 5 starts the general stipulations. Okay, remember we talked about Deuteronomy is in the form of an ancient Hittite treaty. Okay, chapters 1 to 4, the historical prologue, we've completed that. Chapters 5 through 11 are going to be the general stipulations. In secular covenants, the general stipulations were the fundamental principles that all the other laws were hung on. Okay, so they were the broad rules that all the other little rules all had to be tied back to them, were based on. Okay, it's the purpose, the goals, and the agenda for all the specific laws that will follow. Okay, so in Deuteronomy, it's the same. The Ten Commandments are going to be the general laws that all the specific laws, chapters 12 to 26, are going to be the specific stipulations. So every specific stipulation, specific law, has to be tied back to one of the ten. Okay? And when we get there, we'll talk about it. But there are laws like don't mix seed in the field and don't mix cloth, different kinds of cloth in your clothes. And you're like, how in the world do those tie back to the ten? They do. Okay? We'll get there. Eventually, long time. It might take a while, okay, but we'll get there. But this is how Hittite treaties work. All the specific laws have to tie back to the general stipulation. So the Ten Commandments are going to rule the rest of Deuteronomy. And if you understand that, it will help make a lot of the rest of the specific laws make more sense. Okay? If we know that they're all going to tie back to these ten. Deuteronomy is different than a secular covenant, and that God cares about the heart and the vertical. God cares about Israel's relationship with him, okay? Laws are inherently horizontal. Laws are inherently, right, don't murder, okay? So that is how I treat somebody else, okay? Inherently, don't speed. Why are we not supposed to speed, right? Because you might be a danger to somebody else, okay? So laws are typically horizontal. Our government doesn't care what your heart is like, right? So long as you don't murder and you don't speed, right? If you physically obey the laws on the external, they don't really care what your heart is doing, right? Okay, God's different. He does care about what your heart is doing, okay? So in Deuteronomy, we have to establish the vertical relationship too, Okay, which obviously secular covenants of the ancient Near East did not have to do. Okay, because for God, the external actions are only as good as the internal reality. Okay, so chapter 6 through, because, okay, general stipulations are chapters 5 to 11. Well, the Ten Commandments are in chapter 5, so what's the purpose of chapter 6 to 11? Right? It's all about their vertical relationship with God, right? And that's where you'd get Deuteronomy 6:4. Right? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, right? So 6 through 11 is going to establish Israel's relationship with God vertically, right? Which secular covenants didn't care about. Okay, questions on that? Okay, I'm going to, just for our reference, because we're going to start talking about the Ten Commandments, okay, and just so that we have them, all right? One, right, is no other gods. Two, no idols, and this is going to be specifically that represent Yahweh. Okay. Three, don't take God's name in vain. Four is the Sabbath. Don't work on Sabbath. Five, right, is honor parents. Six, don't murder, right? I believe, don't murder. Yep. Okay, so it's murder. Seven is adultery. Eight is theft or false witness? Eight is theft. Okay. Don't steal. Nine is false witness. And 10 is covet. Okay. All right. So, first, for the Ten Commandments. We, in our evangelicalism and in our U.S., you know, we like to post these 10 in our courtrooms, in our schoolrooms, and we bemoan the fact that they've been taken down and all that, which is all great and everything. However, you memorize these 10 like this, you take them totally out of context of what God gave them, and they lose 95% of their meaning. Okay, great. It's great to say don't murder. But do you know why God said don't murder? Do you know what that really means? Because it means a lot more than just don't murder. Okay, so Abner likes to say, we like to look at these as the Big Ten. You take the Big Ten out of its context and it loses its meaning. Okay, this list was never meant to just be memorized like this. Okay, the Ten Commandments is much more than just when we read through this what we think. Okay? You have to understand the Ten Commandments in context of Genesis 1 through 3, Exodus 20, and Deuteronomy 1 through 4. You take the Ten Commandments out of the context in which they were given, and we don't understand them anymore. Okay? Because Abner likes to say, actions speak louder than words, right? These Ten Commandments promote actions, either do this or don't do something, right? That communicate theology about God, what Israel was supposed to communicate about God, okay? So when we divorce this from its context, it loses that meaning, okay? When we don't understand what these Ten Commandments were supposed to communicate about God, then we don't really understand them. Okay. For example, don't take God's name in vain, right? A lot of times we like to understand that just don't swear. Okay, that command means lots more than that. It can include that, but that's not the sole meaning of don't take God's name in vain. Okay. Also, we like to look at this and say these are a lot of do's and don'ts. Okay, but loving God is the heart and central theology of the law, right? Deuteronomy 6:5, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Okay? And do you remember Matthew 22? right? Let's go there. Somebody read for me Matthew 22, 34 to 40.
When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they came together. And one of them, an expert in the law, asked a question to test him. Teacher, which command in the law is the greatest? He said to him, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. This is the greatest and most important command. The second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two commands.
Okay, so Jesus himself says the entire law is centralized around loving God. Okay, love of God, and the second is like it, love of neighbor. So love is at the heart of the law. Okay, this is not just a bunch of do's and don'ts. God's concerned about the heart. Okay? right, it's not just about external keeping rules. God often condemns Israel for their mere external keeping of the laws. Right, Isaiah 1, I'll read it really quick. Isaiah 1:11. God says, what are your multiplied sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings and rams. Excuse me, God. You're the one that said we're supposed to do that, right? He's like, your multiple, think about it. Remember when we wrote out all the animals that had to be sacrificed? Do you remember that in Numbers? Through all the festivals throughout the years? Throughout the year, right? That's multiple sacrifices because there was a morning and an evening sacrifice every single day, right? But God says, I'm sick of it and the fat of fed cattle, and I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls and lambs and goats. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? Bring your worthless offerings no longer. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies. I cannot endure iniquity in the solemn assembly. God's the one that commanded them to do all those things. But what's the problem? Why is God sick of it? Because their heart. They're just externally following the rules, but their heart is not, they do not love God with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength. So God doesn't care about all this if your heart is not in the right place, right? The whole book of Hosea, right? God is mad at Israel. Why? Because they don't externally follow the law? No, because they have broken their marriage covenant. And that's why he tells Hosea to go take Gomer, and she's going to run away from you, and you got to go get her back. Because it's an example, it's an analogy of what Israel has done to God. They have abandoned God in their heart. They have taken the law, and they have only done it, and even then they haven't even done that much, right? But whenever they obey the law, they only obey the externalities. They do not obey it from the heart. Okay, so you have to remember through all the do's and don'ts, the heart of the law is to love God and love neighbor. Okay? Structure of the Ten Commandments. How do we usually break these down?
4 and 6.
4, yeah. 1 through 4 is what?
The worship.
And 5 through 10?
People.
Yep. So often we say, right? These 4, right? And these 6. So this is love God, right? Exactly what Jesus says, right? And this is love neighbor. Okay, so in our terminology, this would be the vertical, and this would be the horizontal. Okay, this is fine, but what it fails to do is each of these horizontals have to tie back into this. If the heart of the law is to love God, then we cannot just have honor parents just because that's how you should treat your parents. It has to tie back up here some way. It has to tie back to God. Does that make sense? Okay. We'll see if I can explain this. Okay. So, what we have is, I'm just going to write numbers, but you can refer back to this. Okay, so 1 and 2 and 5 go together. Okay, so that's this one, and this one. Okay? 1 and 2, don't have any other gods before me, okay, and no idols to represent Yahweh. So if you look at your text, Deuteronomy 5, verse 7 and verse 8, Verse 7 is the first command. Verse 8 is the second command. Okay? It says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol. In the Hebrew, the words, the terminology is very similar in those two verses. Okay, so they parallel each other. The wording is very similar. Okay, no other gods, don't make yourself an idol. Which even when we look at these, right, even in the English, we can see that it's the same idea. Number one is saying, there's no God but Yahweh. Number two is saying, you can't represent Yahweh with anything created. Okay, so it's talking about the positionhood of God. He is above all else. He is above all of creation. So there are no other gods, and you can't even represent him with anything that's been created. Why? Because he is positionally above everything. Okay, then we have 5, which is honoring your parents. Okay, if you look into the text, so the second command goes from verse 8 through verse 10. Okay, verse 9, you shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands. Okay, so it's talking about the third and the fourth generations. Okay, if you don't obey this command, there are going to be consequences that are going to be passed down through the generations. Okay, if you look at command 5, which is verse 16. Honor your father and your mother, as the Lord your God has commanded you, that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you on the land which the Lord your God gives you. Okay? So, if you honor your father and mother, what happens? Your days will be prolonged. And what are you going to see? Generation. Yes, horizontal blend. But if you live a long time, what are you going to see? Generation after generation come after you. Right? So we have generation after generation in command 2, and the idea of if you obey this, generation after generation is going to come after you in the land. Okay? We'll talk about this later too, but why do you honor your parents? Abigail, if you can't obey mom and dad, what's going to happen? You can't
be right with God.
Yeah, you can't obey God. If you don't learn this, you're not going to know this. If you cannot honor the positional authority that God has placed over you, you are never going to learn how to have no other God but God. If you can't obey mom, you can't obey God. Okay, so these three are commands of positional authority. Does that make sense? Okay, have I lost anyone yet? Make sense?
Positional authority is what you said, right?
Yes. So these are the position of God, right? He is positionally above everything. Then he puts parents positionally above children, right? And they are to honor. Now, this is going to be an honoring throughout your life, not when you're just a little child, but also when you're an adult as well. But still, they are put in a position of authority over you. And you need to be able to do the horizontal before you are able to do the vertical. Okay.
And I think that goes along with, yeah, the little ones, but it also goes along with us, with our parents.
Yes.
Honoring our parents in their old age.
That's right. That's right.
It never stops.
Exactly. And that's why I think the command here is honor your parents, right? It's in Ephesians 6 that it says children obey. This doesn't say obey, right? Because Moses is giving this primarily to the second generation, right, who are going to enter the land. So he is speaking primarily to adults. The ironic thing is a lot of their parents are dead because they were the first generations.
It also says you leave your father and mother,
right,
and you cling to your wife, so you're not in obedience to your parents anymore,
right?
But you are in the position of having to,
right,
honor.
But you have to learn that honor as a child. I guess you don't have to, but it's a lot easier to honor your parents as an adult when you have learned that as a child, right, than to never be taught to honor your parents and then they get old and you need to take care of them. At that point, you're probably not going to honor them because that's never been part of any of it. Okay? Okay, so 1, 2, and 5 go together. Then we have 3 and 6 through 9. Okay? So that's don't take God's name in vain, and these ones. Murder, adultery, steal, false witness. Okay. So got to look at our text for this. Verse 11 is command 3. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Okay, do you see that? Name of the Lord your God in vain, takes his name in vain twice. See that? Okay, what do we call that? What style of writing is that? It's called a chiasm. Do you remember? When something at the beginning is the same as something at the end, and then what's the emphasis supposed to be? In the middle. So we have, should not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, who takes his name in vain. So we have name in vain twice, right? So what's in the middle? He will not leave him unpunished. Okay, so this is the emphasis. And then what? Okay, so. So, right, you will be punished, right? Okay, but you have to see this in the Hebrew, and I am not a Hebrew scholar in the slightest, so I totally steal all of this from Abner Chow. Okay, but in the Greek, in the Hebrew, okay, not leave him unpunished, it's 3 words in the Hebrew. Okay, basically, I think not him unpunished, something like that in the Hebrew. And what's funny is, do you notice how command 1 is short? But until you get to command 6, 7, 8, and 9, they're all pretty long, or they're all much longer than 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? And then you get to 6, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal, don't bear false witness. Okay, they're all very short, right? It's because they are all in the Hebrew mirroring in that same pattern as don't leave him unpunished. The first word is not, lo, I think, in the Hebrew, okay? So it, do not murder, you shall not murder is 3 words in the Hebrew, and it starts with the not, okay? Not you murder, something like that. I don't know exactly what the Hebrew is. But what it does is it parallels that middle part of don't take God's name in vain. Does that make sense? Okay? Now, if you understand that, if you understand that these are tied to this, you get your first hint that don't take God's name in vain means a whole lot more than not just saying, oh my God, because that's how we take it. That's what this means, right?
More like don't take God's name in vain with all of that. Sometimes don't disrespect his essence.
Exactly, exactly. Because how do you take God's name in vain sometimes? By this, right? And what did Jesus say about these on the Sermon on the Mount? You have heard that it was said, don't murder. I tell you, right, that what? If you hate a brother in your heart, you have committed murder, right? You have heard that it was said, don't commit adultery. I tell you, if you look at a woman lustfully, you've already committed adultery with her, right? So this gives a whole lot more meaning to don't take God's name in vain. Right, and that is the reason why 6, 7, 8, and 9 are really short, because they are copying that same idea that's in the middle of verse 11.
In other words, you're going to be punished.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
For 6, 7, 8, and 9.
Right, right. Okay. Right. I mean, it adds against the against your neighbor, it adds that, but, I mean, the core of the commandment is don't lie. You shall not bear false witness, which I'm sure bear false witness in the Hebrew is probably one word, but in the English, right, we have to translate it out. Okay, so what 2 does that leave? 4 and 10. Okay, look at verse 4, command 4, verse 12. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded. 6 days you shall do your labor and do your work, but on the seventh day is the Sabbath day of the Lord. In it you shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your ox, your donkey, your cattle, sojourner, male, female servant. Okay? So it lists all the things that are not supposed to work. Right? Your ox, your donkey, your servant, your male servant. 21. You shall not covet your male's wife. You shall not desire your male's house, or his field, or his male servant, female servant, his ox, his donkey. Okay? So Moses repeats, right? When he says, don't let anything work, he didn't have to write, list out everything that's not supposed to work. Don't let your male servant work. Don't let your female servant work. Don't let your ox work. Don't let your donkey work, right? But he does it because he wants to tie it. He repeats himself down in verse 21. Don't covet. Don't covet your male servant, your female servant, your ox, your donkey. It's supposed to be a clue. Pay attention. These two are linked together. And that's why Moses says it this way. Okay? So, Sabbath, right? Sabbath. Do we remember what the Sabbath day was supposed to represent?
Rest.
With God, right? And Sabbath is linked to all the festivals and the feasts, right? Because it'll say this, and then you should treat it like a Sabbath day and nobody should work, right? And the idea is God is God over your time. God is sovereign over your time, okay? You should not covet. Don't want what other people have, right? Why? You need to be content with what God gave you. God is sovereign over your stuff. God is sovereign over your time, which is something that God has given you. And God is sovereign over your stuff, which is what God has given you. You need to be content. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Questions?
You did really well. I heard
Oh, you did? Yeah. Well, so like I said, then there's not an original thought in my head. This is all from Abner Joe.
It's hard to explain, though.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't get 4 and 10. I don't understand how they fit together.
Okay. With the repeating of the words?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at your text, right, it will say, look, I mean, okay, so let's start with verse 21, right? You're not to covet your neighbor's wife. You should not desire your neighbor's house, his field, right, or his male servant, his female servant, his ox and his donkey. Do you see those four? Okay. Look up at verse 14, the middle of it. What are you not supposed to let work? Your male servant? Your female servant? Your ox? Or your donkey? Okay, do you see how they're the same? Okay, so that's how you tie them together. Moses is repeating himself down in verse 21 of the thing. Now, it's not everything. Okay. But he is repeating himself. You can see that.
Yeah.
Okay? So the idea is Sabbath, the idea behind Sabbath is that God is in control of your time. He's the one that dictates your time, what you do, right? Because there's a reason that we have 365 days in a year, right? Because it's how long the sun takes us to go around the sun. There's a reason we have 24 hours in a day, because it's how long the world takes to turn, right? There's no other reason. 28 days in a lunar month makes sense because it's when the moon, right? But 7 days in a week, the only reason we have that is because God created the world in 6 days and rests on the seventh, right? So Sabbath, God establishes Sabbath day saying, I am in charge of your time. And with Israel specifically, he says, I am in charge of your calendar. You're going to go into land, you're going to spread out, and I'm going to dictate that, I think there are three festivals, everybody has to come to Jerusalem and celebrate. Okay, I'm in charge. You do things my way and when I tell you to. And I'm telling you that every Sabbath day you have to rest. And none of these things can work. Okay, then we get to verse 21, the do not covet, right? And God's saying, I'm in charge of what you have. I have given you what I have given you. And you need to be content. You don't get to look at lists and say, I want your swimming pool. God didn't give you a swimming pool. Okay? So you cannot be jealous of Liz and want her swimming pool. Right? God has given you what he's given you. He's in charge of what he's given you. You don't get to look out at something else and say, I want that. What God gave me is not good enough. I want my neighbor's wife. I want my neighbor's servants. He has more donkeys than I do. I only have two. He has five. You know, whatever. You have to be content with what God gave you because he's sovereign over how you structure your time and what stuff you have. Does that make a little more sense? Okay.
Is
Good. More questions?
Okay. The Sabbath, as you are saying it now, is God is sovereign over our time. The Sabbath, even according to Moses, the law, became more than that in terms of what should be included or not included in it. And then in the New Testament, the Sabbath is the one command that's never repeated.
Yeah, we're going to get there.
Okay,
sorry. Okay, no, that's all right. No, that's all right. That's a great question. Okay, we have 10 minutes. All right.
Not today, Israel.
Well,
no, it's okay.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
We'll see. We might. Okay, because the next thing we're going to do is this is the one thing that really helped me, I feel like, understand the Ten Commandments better and understand how they actually apply to us today. Okay? Because all 10 commandments connect back to Genesis 1 to 3. Okay? So we are going to trace each commandment back to Genesis 1 to 3 and talk about then how that helps us to view our relationship to the Ten Commandments. Okay? So, command 1. Okay? You shall have no other gods before me. The word for God used in verse 7, okay, is Elohim, not Yahweh. It's Elohim. You shall have no Elohim before me. Okay? If you remember, what is the word for God used in chapter 1 of Genesis? Elohim. Okay, do you remember? This is the whole crazy JEPD theory. Do you remember the name for God used in chapter 2 of Genesis? Yahweh, right? And then that's why they say they have two different offers. Okay, it's ridiculous. Okay, but if you look at Genesis 1, right? In the beginning, God, Elohim, right? The Spirit of God, Elohim. Verse 3, then God said. Verse 4, God, God. Verse 5, God. Verse 6, God. Verse 7, God. Verse 8, God. Verse 9, then God, right? 10, God. 11, God. God. Over and over and over and over. I mean, Moses, really? Did you need to repeat it that many times? But the point is, in chapter 1 of Genesis, the whole thesis is this is Elohim, creator God, and there is nobody else. There is no other God. It's just Elohim, 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 over and over and over and over again. It's like beating a dead horse. Israel, do you get it? There's nobody else. It's just God. Elohim. Okay? Israel is to live this out practically for the world to see. You cannot have another God because there isn't one, right? The word Elohim means the supreme God. If there is a supreme God, you can't have another supreme God. Because if there is somebody that's over, then this one's no longer Elohim, that one is. Does that make sense? Okay, so Elohim is like number one, top dog, supreme God. There cannot be anybody above Elohim. And in Genesis chapter 1, you just have it drilled into your head. It's Elohim over and over and over again. He's the one doing this. He's the one speaking the world into being, creating. Okay? So the thesis of Genesis 1 is that creator God, he is the only one there is. He is the top one. There is no other God. There isn't one that's above him. Thus, we have the first command. Okay, you, Israel, can have no other gods because there isn't another God, and it uses the same name for God that is used in Genesis 1. Okay, on purpose. Make sense? Okay, let's look at the second command. Verse 8, you shall not make for yourselves an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above, on the earth beneath, or the water under the earth. What should those all make you think of?
Creation.
Those are days 1 through 3, where God creates the spheres of creation, heaven above, water, and earth, right? Do you remember the days of creation? He creates the spheres on days 1 through 3 and he fills them on days 4 through 6. Do we remember this?
Yes.
So on day
4, 2, and 5.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so on day 1, he says, let there be light. He creates the heavens, right? Day 4, he creates the sun, moon, and stars. Day 2, he says, let the waters be separated. And then day 5, he creates the birds and the fish, right? And then day three, he creates the land, and day six, he fills the land with all the animals. Okay? So, heavens above, earth, and water. They're spheres of creation, but it says, or any likeness of what is in. Okay? So it's referring not only to the spheres, but it's referring to anything that fills them. The sun, moon, and stars, the fish, the birds, or the land animals. Okay? So the second command is saying God is creator God, and you cannot represent him with anything in creation. Okay? Because look at chapter 1 of Genesis. He created it all. So if God made it, there is nothing in what he has made that you can use to represent him. Because anytime you try, you're going to absolutely fail because it is not going to be able to capture God. Why? Because he is creator God, and you are just trying to use creation to represent God. Okay, nothing that is created can represent God. Positionally, there is no other God. He is the highest, and there is nothing that can represent him because he's the one that made it. So nothing in what he made can fully represent who he is. Does that make sense? Okay. Three, you shall not take the name of Yahweh your God in vain. Okay. We've talked about this a lot in Exodus, right? Because does anyone know how does Exodus starts or what the name of Exodus is in Hebrews? Names. Yes, these are the names. Okay, Ryan, we talked about in Exodus, it's really important who's named and who's not named, right? The midwives are named, Pharaoh is not named. Genesis 1, we've talked about this as well. What does God not name? Oh, he doesn't do that. He gives that job to Adam, but specifically of the sun, moon, and stars. He just calls them the greater light and the lesser light, right? He doesn't name them, okay? Because what's Israel going to be so tempted to do? Worship them, because all the rest of the ancient Near East, they worshiped the sun, moon, and stars as gods. God, in Genesis 1, right, if you look, verse 14, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night. Let them be for lights, right? Verse 16, God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He doesn't even name them because they are not even worthy of names. Because they are so far below God that how could you even begin to think that they're gods? They're not even worthy to be named. Okay? Don't take the name of God in vain. But God, who does God? God takes for himself a name in Genesis 1 and 2, does he not? What's his name in Genesis 1? Elohim. He is supreme top dog God. Okay? What's his name in Genesis 2? Yahweh. That's his personal name that he gives Moses in Exodus 3, right? I am who I am. You are to know me personally, Israel. You are to know who I am. You are to know my essence, right? We can know somebody's name, right? We know Joe Biden's name. Does that mean we really know who he is? We can know things about him and things that he does, but do we really know him? No, we don't. But God is saying to Israel, in creation, I have given you my name. You are to be my people, and you are to represent who I am. You are to know me personally. Joyce, are we good? Okay. All right. Four, easy, Sabbath. How's that tie back to creation? God rests on seventh day. To your question, Terry. Genesis 2:2. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all his work which God had created and made. Okay? God establishes Sabbath in Genesis 2. What's missing from that? That's in this commandment. Who doesn't work on Sabbath day here in Genesis 2? God. Who's not supposed to work versus in this command? Us. In Genesis 2, does it say we can't work? No, because think back to what you know about Genesis. Okay? Sabbath day is also the only day that doesn't say morning and evening, the seventh day, right? Do you remember this when we studied Genesis 2 way long time ago? What was the significance? Sabbath was to be eternal. We were to live in Sabbath with God, enjoying what he did. Now, God gave Adam a job to do, right? To name all the animals and to rule and have dominion. If Sabbath day is never supposed to end, then therefore Adam has to be able to work in Sabbath day, right? But it is not until Genesis 3 and the fall, right, when everything comes crumbling down and basically Sabbath rest, eternal Sabbath rest gets destroyed. And we've talked about how the rest of the Bible, we are constantly wanting to get back to Sabbath rest. Okay? So we do not get a command not to work until we get to the Ten Commandments. So Exodus 20 and then Deuteronomy 5. All right? But it is based back in Genesis 2 where it is God who rested. That is the Sabbath day. Okay, we're going to stop there because we are out of time. We are out of time. But we will continue this, and next week we will talk about how we are then to understand our position under the Ten Commandments and how it's supposed to apply to us.